Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Mobilityism Method series. The series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilityism Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilityism Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. My name is Aliza Arıcan. Today, I'm joined by Gayatri Nair, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the Indraprastha Institute of Information Technology. We'll be talking about her book, Set Adrift, Capitalist Transformations and Community Politics Along Mumbai's Shores, recently published by Oxford University Press. Thank you very much, Dr. Nair, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, and I really enjoyed the book. But before we delve into the book, we have quite a bit of a convention at the New Books Network, and we like to start by getting to know our authors a little bit more closely. So could you tell us about your background as a sociologist?
Absolutely. So my sort of relationship with sociology has been quite a long one now. I began by doing my undergraduate degree in sociology at the University of Mumbai. I was at the St. Xavier's College. And I actually sort of stumbled upon sociology. I wasn't entirely certain what I was getting into when I first decided to study it. But once I did, I fell absolutely in love with it and sort of haven't moved past it ever since. So I've stuck with it. So at St. Xavier's College, I majored in sociology. I also studied history and literature alongside. But then I followed it up with a master's in sociology. So I went to the Savitribai Phule Pune University. So that's a city in the state of Maharashtra. And then from there, I moved to Delhi, where I moved to the Jawaharlal Nehru University. And I completed my MPhil and my PhD in sociology. So it's been a long journey. And like I said, wasn't entirely sure what I was getting into, but it's been a really fruitful journey so far. And I consider myself really lucky to be able to continue that and actually now, hold down a position in sociology. So, of course, series of precarious jobs, but now finally I can have that career in sociology.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also feel very lucky that you stuck with this path and came up with this book. And, you know, I really enjoyed like hearing a bit about the mobilities embedded in your path to sociology. Yes. And how, you know, we have to move in these circuitous paths to, you know, come up with these books or pieces of writing. So thanks for sharing that. And, you know, having spoken a little bit about your engagement with sociology, it ended up with Set Adrift, at least for now. And in the book, you center on the Koli community and fishing in Mumbai to make important contributions on urban life, mobility, gender, and the commons, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But first, for our listeners who might not be familiar with the Indian context, could you tell us a little bit about the Koli community in Mumbai? What compelled you to write about them and to conceive of this book?
Right. So thank you for that question, actually. So the Koli community is actually a community that is a caste community that has practiced fishing for many centuries now. They actually consider themselves indigenous to the islands of Mumbai. And, you know, their history is very much sort of intertwined with the history of Mumbai as well. And this is a community that, you know, it's very interesting because the community has been seen as a symbol of Mumbai, right? But in maybe in visual culture and in popular culture. So, you know, you will find the Kolis almost used as a shorthand symbol for representing Mumbai itself. And in that way, you know, their sort of link with the city is really strong and acknowledged. But this hasn't really translated into, for instance, centering the community in an understanding of Mumbai's economy, of Mumbai's, you know, society, of Mumbai's politics. And that is something that I think is what really set me off in thinking about wanting to work on this. And of course, I also come from, you know, a personal background where I have sort of grown up in cities of India. I have moved quite a bit. I mean, you sort of figured that out in terms of my educational journey. But I've also moved, you know, through my childhood, for instance. And I've always lived in cities, and people speak of, you know, disenchantment with cities, but I've just loved cities all along. So what was very curious to me was that, you know, here's a city about which so much is written and so much is discussed, you know, both historically and in contemporary writing about it. And yet this community that is so central, you know, to the existence of the city doesn't seem to be acknowledged. Or when it is, its acknowledgement is, you know, in these very reductive sort of terms of, you know, like I mentioned, a certain kind of symbolism that is associated with them, and a representation that is very much tied to a static imagination of the community. The idea of this work was very much to kind of center stage the community itself and to, you know, think about the city from the perspective of the community and how they look upon the city, how they look upon their work and what they do. And like I mentioned, they've been a community of fishers. So, you know, the caste community in Mumbai has practiced fishing. And because of this kind of historical link and, you know, the claims of indigeneity they make, there's also this sort of political assertion about the place that they hold within the city. And I think that's what made me very interested in wanting to write of this book and wanting to think a little bit more about the Koli community in a different way than I had seen otherwise. So that was sort of the idea of center staging the community. But in terms of thinking about what had to be done, I think the focus was on trying to capture in some ways the dynamism of the community itself and really not see them as rooted in the past, as these kind of figures from the past that have a haunting presence in Mumbai, but rather to think about the ways in which they are very much part of, you know, the modern sort of city of Mumbai and in all its sort of bustling nature and how their work, their livelihood, you know, their lives are intertwined with the city itself.
This is fascinating. You know, this is fascinating, and I love how, you know, you show us that representation and quote-unquote theory of a book are co-constitutive and, you know, are really intertwined. And I want to follow up on that a little bit. So, you know, a central theme of the book is urban transformation and the question of who does the city belong to? So I was wondering if you could speak to this question, especially through the work you do of centering the Koli community. What does this recentering, so to speak, do to answer these questions?
Right. So I think the idea was that, you know, when we think about urban transformations and who are really the subjects of that change and who really gets to participate in that process of change, you know, it was very evident, and it has been evident for any, you know, any anthropologist, any sociologist who pays close attention to these questions, that, I mean, of course, there are power relations at work. These are, you know, there are political economic shifts that sort of determine, you know, who can and cannot participate in these kind of processes. And so in thinking about these ideas of urban transformation, I think the notion of, or the idea of center staging the Kolis was to show how part of their struggle, I mean, of course, you know, and you could read it at one level, it's just a struggle over livelihoods. You could read it as a struggle over retaining control over resources. But I think it was much more than that, and it is much more than that. I think really part of that movement and part of that struggle is about an assertion of who that city actually belongs to and who gets to participate in it and who doesn't. And I think what was very interesting was that, you know, so many, you know, conflicting positions emerge because you have on the one hand a large process of urban transformation. You have this capital-driven process of urbanization that is literally transforming the terrain of the city. And you can see this a sort of, you know, concerted attempt at pushing out, you know, or minimalizing the commons, of minimalizing the space for livelihoods that thrive on resources that don't fit within this typical urban imagination. And of course, you know, to push out in some ways the Koli community itself, which has been historically marginalized as well. And you could see in this struggle and assertion to claim the city for themselves. And simultaneously, one could also see what those, you know, conflicting positions led to, because there was also in an attempt to assert a claim over the city, you also had moments where that claim had to be made vis-a-vis another, right? By sort of arguing that a right could be secured only by defining in very sort of exclusive terms who the city belongs to. And that meant identifying also who it did not belong to. And those are the moments that we, of tension that we really see within the movement itself and how it sort of grapples with those kinds of questions. So I think, you know, when we think about these kind of processes of change, you know, whether we're talking about capitalist transformations, whether we're talking about urban changes and shifts that are happening, I think it's important to kind of center stage communities that lie on the margins precisely for this, because these processes are, of course, in some ways acting out upon them, but they are not passive recipients of it. They respond in all kinds of ways. And I think the ways in which that resistance is built, the way in which an articulation of rights happens, the way in which claim making takes place, can tell us a lot about the ways in which a politics of the future is also imagined, you know, in terms of how is the urban process really conceived of by these communities themselves and the Kolis in particular. So I think, you know, center staging can enable that kind of understanding, which is what the attempt was in the book at least.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have to say one of the strengths of this book is, you know, raising all these claims with all their complexities and all the tensions. And this brings me to my question on mobility and tension. So you show us that mobilities are in tension at the site of fishing labor. So you really center labor to show the dynamic nature of mobility. And we see that gender, caste, citizenship create frictions between Koli women workers and migrant men, for example. So how can we understand the relationship between these capitalist transformations and mobility by paying close attention to these tensions? Or in other words, what is at stake with sort of putting these tensions in center stage?
Right. So again, thank you for that question, because it really helped me to sort of reflect back on the process of the book. I mean, it's been some years since the research happened. So this is useful. I think, you know, one of the things that that again is enabled via center staging these tensions is really to move apart from from sort of reductive positions that we tend to take around questions of transformations, mobilities, etc. And I think this was, you know, the field really threw this back at me. It was very evident that there is going to be no way to really understand or explore even what is really going on without actually paying closer attention to these tensions. So I think what focusing on those tensions allows us to do is to really capture the complexity that is at work. I think I had a keen sort of attempt I was making throughout to not fall for those kind of, you know, large macro sort of narratives that can sometimes flatten out nuance. But I was also very keen to not sort of get lost in the intricacies of, of a particular moment or of a particular position, to not be able to also notice the larger changes that may have structured and made possible certain choices and made certain kinds of positions unavailable. So I think when particularly looking at questions of capitalist transformations, I mean, these are, again, you know, these are broad brushstrokes that we can make and sort of describe about what is really happening. But it wouldn't allow us to really capture that the fact that essentially we're talking about a process of social change, and social change is messy. Social change, is absolutely complicated, right? The sort of distance that history gives us can make us turn back and you know, in retrospect, look at something and make certain kinds of generalizations from it. But when something is playing out, it is absolutely complicated. It is absolutely messy. And sometimes there are no easy sort of positions that, that are made available or that are possible. So that is really what I wanted to capture in terms of thinking about this relationship between capitalist transformations and mobilities, and to be able to capture and speak to both levels of in some senses, processes that were unraveling, which were leading to a very sort of varied set of responses that were coming in, so that you couldn't speak of a singular community response. You couldn't speak of a singular way in which, mobilization was taking place. You couldn't speak of a singular way in which resource politics could be characterized. So I think all of that, just to capture the many strands of it, it became necessary to center stage those tensions. And I think focusing on those tensions allows us to grapple with the very real process of change at an everyday level and what that really looks like.
Mm-hmm. This is fascinating. And I think, your multifaceted approach really also helps you think about political mobilizations and how people react to broader social change. For example, in the book, we see what you call competing dispositions, which give rise to multiple political mobilizations. So could you tell us what competing dispositions refer to? And can you also elaborate on what happens to politics when dispositions are in competition? What are the limits and possibilities of political mobilization that competing dispositions give rise to?
Right. So, when I was doing fieldwork for this research, I was pretty much witnessing these moments of mobilization. And I was witnessing the process of in which, you know, organizations were being literally crafted, you know, from the start because of a particularly troubled history with it previously. So when I refer to questions of competing dispossession, I'm really trying to point out to the fact that in the course of, you know, political mobilization, in the course of, you know, social movements and how they really play out, there can be a situation where different communities of the dispossessed can in some ways be pit against one another. And when I say that, I am not attributing that to the movement, I'm not attributing that to a community, I'm attributing that largely to structural conditions within which a movement sort of plays out and unfolds, right? And so there, when one sort of again pays closer attention to it, you realize that in the course of political mobilization, right, there are of course all kinds of strategic choices that are made, right? It's impossible to be involved in politics and in movements and, you know, address every single question or every single cause that there is. So strategic choices are made, priorities are exercised, right? But that is not a form of competing dispossession. So that is not what I'm referring to. What I want to sort of draw attention to when I talk about competing dispossessions is a form of politics that is built around an idea that necessary trade-offs have to happen for politics to proceed, for mobilization to happen. And I think these are two very different kinds of forms of politics. These are two very different orders of organization, and the strategies that they use are sort of very, very distinct from one another. And the notion of competing dispossession enters in the latter, in the form of politics where the necessary trade-off is made to seem absolutely central and vital for that kind of politics to survive. And of course, you know, when I say this, I'm again pointing to the fact that these are not actually existing trade-offs that have to happen. And that is what I mean when I'm trying to think about the limits of a certain kind of, you know, position that competing politics sort of, competing dispossessions really allows for. Because there are necessary limits to it in terms of thinking about what kind of solidarities are made possible, what kind of allyship is made possible, you know, what are the wide range of political positions that one could take if you are beginning from a point of trade-offs and pitting a community with against another, then it is, like I mentioned earlier, literally the fact you're like sort of translating into politics the fact that a right can only be secured at the cost of another. And that is made to seem as a necessary trade-off that has to be made in the course of doing politics, right? But of course, when one looks very closely at what was happening in, you know, in Mumbai with the Kohli community and with the kinds of different kinds of organizations, political organizations, including political parties that were part of it, you know, if one traces that history, then it becomes evident that competing dispossession is not the only route. And, you know, a necessary trade-off is not the only route. It is entirely possible to conduct politics built around wider solidarities being created, around allyship being created, while still center staging the interests of a community, because they have been subject to a history of marginalization, they have been subject to processes that continue to dispossess them, right? So that is what I was thinking in terms of the limits of competing dispossession. And if I was to think about the possibilities in it, then it is only possible, really. I mean, the political possibilities really only open up if you are to think about it as a form of strategic prioritization that is not coming at the cost of another, but that is simply about what is possible in the immediate circumstance. Mm-hmm.
This is fascinating. And this brings me to my next question about the commons. So, you know, in contexts like Mumbai's shores, where the city rapidly transforms, markets are made, and politics is ever more fractured, as you so beautifully explained us, what of the urban commons? How does the case of Mumbai's fishing communities complicate or expand the idea of urban commons?
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Again, thank you for that question. it's again, like, really useful as a way to, an entry point to think about the commons again. And I think, you know, the Kohli community's life, livelihood, living, work, all of it really speaks in some ways to, is a testament to the commons, really. Right. Mm. And I think when we look at the commons in a city like Mumbai, particularly, you know, where it's land starved, or it's a very densely populated city, you know, the commons seem like an anachronism. Like, it seems like a relic from the past, and there have been concerted attempts at sort of literally wiping them off the map. And yet they persist, yet they continue. That speaks, I think, definitely to a certain resilience of both the commons and the communities that keep them alive. But I don't want to romanticize this either and make it seem like, you know, this is, you know, that again, that they are those figures who have always depended on it, who will always continue to depend mm-hmm. on it. Because the Kohlis, much like any other community that inhabits Mumbai, are, you know, subjects of this modern city. They are looking to change. They have aspirations that may actually lead them to a path outside of the commons. So it is, it is a complicated sort of situation and a complicated history for the community to navigate as well, and a complicated present for them to navigate as well. But I think what is very interesting is that when we look at the commons in Mumbai, and if, you know, in many ways I'm looking at the sea as a part of the commons, this is really the commons that the Kohlis are claiming. I also think it's a very different kind of common in that sense. It's not a common over which the community has sort of exclusive access or exclusive control. You know, there are all kinds of implications with the sea, economic, social, you know, also in terms of national security, for instance. So the state plays a very important role in terms of the seas and how, you know, they are regulated and legislated. You know, there are all kinds of laws at work. Again, not just national laws, but also because you have international waters. So you have another set of, you know, other kinds of players that we are really looking at. So the seas are a complicated form of the commons, right? And yet this is the form of the common that has been most central in defining community identity, community life and livelihood. And this is a common over which they have built, you know, a sort of long practice of livelihood and labor. They've built a long, they've established regimes of use that have, you know, undergone changes over a period of time. So I think what, looking at the Kohli community and their, you know, their sort of interrelationship with the commons allows us to do is really to think about the ways in which the commons contribute also so much to the city, you know, via the relationship again with the community. They are, again, such a central part of the city and that urban imagination, even if urban policy and planning doesn't really see a holistic space for them. And, you know, over the last few years, environmentalism has become, in some ways, a mainstream concern. It's become a question that people, a large number of people do think about, a large number of young people think about and talk about. And, of you know, it's been an important and vital shift to happen. But I think what the relevance of the work that the Kohli community does in both politically and you know, through their social existence is also the fact that they, you know, they tie the question of the commons and its link to the urban, not just in terms of, you know, the environmental discourse alone, right? So not just by saying that, you know, keeping the urban commons alive is vital for, you know, building, let's say, a green city or like making a city climate change adaptable and sustainable and so on and so forth. But I think it's also about really reflecting and foregrounding the fact that social life, right, that labor, that economic contributions are also rooted through the commons, even though we imagine that in a city like Mumbai, that will not happen. And I think that's definitely the case for a large number of urban commons when we think about it. But in Mumbai in particular, where, you know, the physical terrain of the place doesn't allow us to think that, you know, huge commons are possible, even as the seas, you know, surround it. And I think really the politics of the Koli community has pushed this agenda to say that the commons are vital for all kinds of reasons, and not just the limited reasons that possibly circulate in certain kind of political domains.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. This is very fascinating. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about your methodology that led you to these insights. So I love that your methodology kind of mirrors your theoretical framework, and you discuss that gender and mobility play an important role in how you did this research. So could you speak to how you positioned yourself and how you moved through your fieldwork?
Absolutely. So, I mean, it was important for me, and I think in many ways doing any kind of fieldwork makes you, you know, rethink and sort of focus and be reflexive about your own position and the way in which you negotiate the field, right? But it was very evident to me right at the start that gender was going to be something that I focused on. And initially, the idea of that was just that I really wanted to, again, within, you know, a larger sort of question about the marginalization or the erasure of the Koli community itself, I found a sort of subtext of the fact that Koli women's work and Koli women themselves were being either represented or not in very reductive ways, or weren't being represented in ways that they actually wanted to be. So the idea that I should focus on gender, for instance, you know, was important right at the start over there. And of course, because I was looking at movements, and because the work itself, right, the labor of fishing or fishing-related activities mm-hmm. itself requires this kind of understanding of mobility. I mean, it's built around mobility, really. Both of these as sort of pegs for how, you know, the field had to be navigated was very evident at the start. But I think what, you know, what that journey of and what that process of, you know, ethnographic work and navigating the field really allowed me to do was, of course, to be reflexive on my own position. And so then I, you know, the ways in which certain spaces opened up for me was really sort of dependent on all kinds of, you know, all kinds of sort of, no, let me reframe that. The way in which the way in which I was able to navigate and access the field came down to certain key interlocutors who I first met with, who kind of opened out certain paths for me. It was very, like, again, it was very central and important to me and to the work that I actually try and understand the larger fish workers movement as well. And, you know, key figures of that movement, you know, Mr. Rambhav Patil, who was the head of the National Fish Workers Forum at that point, for instance, thought very well of the university that I went to, for instance, right? And that, you know, allowed him, I mean, that sort of gave me a certain kind of credibility, which allowed him to introduce me to all kinds of other movement spaces. And, you know, he spoke, for instance, of the fact that, you know, research was happening in this university on the community, on the movement, which was important. And I mean, that was invaluable in terms of opening up movement spaces for me, right? So that was one part of it. I had close friendships with friends who came from the community, so that opened up certain kinds of spaces. But I realized also very quickly that just as much as gender and mobility were going to be were going to have to be mapped onto the work I wanted to do, they were also going to sort of map themselves onto me. And there were things that I could, that I was going to be able to do, and there were things that I wasn't going to be able to do. So I was not, for instance, able to form those kind of relationships that allowed me, for instance, to access the world of fishing in the way that I could mm-hmm. access the world of fishing-related activities, for instance, the drying of fish, the curing of fish, the selling of fish from various mm-hmm. markets. And that was primarily because of the sex-based division of labor that is practiced, where men go out to fish and women are doing sort of post-harvest work. So because, I identify as a woman, those spaces became much more available to me, and I was really able to understand those, inhabit those worlds for a little while in a way that I couldn't do for, let's say, the work of fishing and to understand the labor of fishing itself. And in terms of mobility, also that became a problem. So, I've written about this in the book as well, about how, just the ways in which fishing is done and the number of days that a boat goes out to sea and, the ways, the time that is spent, and all of those prove to be certain kinds of impediments in being able to access that form of work and to really understand it. I had important figures who opened the place out, but there were also these kinds of restrictions that emerged. But I think, that's part and parcel of these processes of like understanding and inhabiting these kind of worlds, right? Where you where certain things do become more available and open mm-hmm. to access and understand, and certain things get closed off. So I try to be reflexive about that. I try to be mindful of that and acknowledge that very upfront, that definitely this work could not speak to certain key interlocutors who would have been important. It would have been important, for instance, to speak to migrant male fishers who participate in post-harvest work. But the ways in which that work is organized and the inability to sort of enter those mm-hmm. kind of spaces and those kind of aspects of work was a limit. So that is something that I definitely wanted to be upfront about right at the start, although I did struggle with it a lot, I have to say, during the process of research. I felt that the work was incomplete in some ways because it couldn't capture that. But I think now, upon some reflection, I think I've been able to access other parts of this world of work, which wouldn't have been necessarily available to me otherwise. And just in terms of also thinking about like how I navigated it, it was really interesting during the process of my fieldwork, because one of my field sites I found was particularly initially difficult for me to gain access to and gain entry into. The reason for it was I was this, of course, random woman who was this suddenly going around trying to sort of talk to people and get a sense of what is happening and hanging around there. And I was looked upon with a great deal of suspicion, and I found it was a lot, that the gaze of was far more sort of concerned in one location vis-a-vis other kinds of field locations that I had. So I was curious mm-hmm. about why that was happening. And then I realized, thankfully very quickly, that one of these locations that in which I was, conducting my research happened to be a location that had, sort of been involved in the sort of the Bombay terror sort of case that had happened, which is referred to popularly as the 2011 mm-hmm. case. So the boat that had brought in, brought in some of the people who participated in those terror activities had landed right at this fishing village where I was. They were being surveilled quite heavily by the police, and so my presence there became particularly problematic for them because they felt that they would be implicated if something was to go wrong. And so again, I found like, you know, being my identity as a student came quite in handy there, because somehow people at that point, India, I think, was slightly different. People were a bit disarmed by the idea of a young student. And so, you know, having my student ID sort of settled and calmed people down. So, yeah, all kinds of interesting things happen when you're, I think, navigating a field and figuring out how you should position yourself vis-a-vis your field, you know, which identity of yours, I think, becomes important as well.
Yeah, this is fascinating. And I think, you know, what maybe at the time you saw as limits of your work have ultimately become the strengths of the book. And, you know, you also mentioned that you sort of wanted to bring together sort of a grounded perspective together with sort of broader trends, maybe a more macro perspective. And, you know, as an anthropologist, I found your usage of qualitative and quantitative data together very refreshing. So how did these modes of inquiry complement your research? And how did thinking both ethnographically and quantitatively enrich your theoretical and empirical approach?
I have to confess, it was entirely something that I stumbled upon. This is not the way I had actually anticipated what I would actually end up doing. You know, I have been trained as a qualitative sociologist, right? My educational training, I mean, you know, in Indian universities, when you do sociology or anthropology, you have, of course, some courses in quantitative methods. But, you know, by and large, the focus is on qualitative methods. I mean, we really come from that British social anthropology kind of tradition. And so the focus and the thrust was very much on qualitative methods. So I did not anticipate that I would actually end up using anything other than qualitative methods in my study. But I think as I was doing my research, and I felt that there were certain kinds of changes that I wanted to kind of capture and detail, which I felt, you know, couldn't be quite sufficiently done via the qualitative methods. And I think I owe this really to, again, my, you know, in my university interactions with people outside of my discipline, and, you know, discussing with them about different kinds of methods that they bring to their work. And that is really where I got a sense that perhaps, you know, quantitative methods are what are going to be useful here to be able to capture this. So, you know, I for instance, use it to discuss educational transformations and changes that have happened within the community. And that began very much from a qualitative standpoint. So it was in the process of, you know, talking to people really about aspirations of work and, you know, what has been, you know, what have they found possible and what have they been limited by, that the question of education kept coming up. And given the fact that this is a community that has been characterized and you know, hierarchically placed low in the caste order, right? Because of which they actually encountered impediments in the path of education. They were literally kept apart from, you know, and prevented an access to education. I knew that that was going to be an important feature to understand, you know, the life world of the community. But I felt that I needed quantitative methods there to be able to explore what that transformation had been, because there was change, right? There was a sort of upward moving trend in terms of education. We could see very clearly that younger generations were accessing change. And I thought that what I could do was, by combining those two, again, bring forth a detailed sort of granular view of what was really happening, who can access education and what kind of education in a new sort of context where education is an actual possibility, but also then demonstrate or, you know, indicate what, you know, how significant the transformation actually has been. And for that broad brushstroke that I wanted to make, I think the quantitative methods proved to be very useful there. So not planned, entirely something that I landed upon. And I was very fortunate that I actually had friends who trained me once again in those quantitative methods and really helped me make sense, you know, of that data that I actually collected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love hearing how, you know, our works aren't necessarily dialogical and relational, you know, like these important insights often come from collaborations both in and out of our fieldwork. That was wonderful to hear. Before we wrap up, I'd like to ask, what is next for you? What are some new projects or questions in which you're interested currently?
So I'm actually, my starting point even for this research in many ways was really, as I mentioned, a focus on cities and and labor and trying to think through cities from the position of labor. And so in many ways, like, I'm continuing with that, but I've shifted gears a little bit. My current research is actually on looking at how digital technologies sort of operate in the field of labor. A lot of informal work in India, for instance, is happening now, particularly in big Indian cities, is happening through platform work, through the gig economy. And so my current research tries to, again, make sense of this by tying together the macro narrative of what are those large changes and shifts that are happening, and then also focus on the granular details of, you know, who's doing this work and what are the ways in which this work, gets structured, what are work conditions, what happens to the labor process itself when you have the intervention of these kind of digital technologies. So I'm looking at geographically sort of bound forms of platform work. Researching Uber drivers, Ola drivers, those who work in food delivery services, women who work through platforms that provide beauty and spa work. And through that, again, trying to make sense of the city, of labor, and what might the future of work really look like.
Mm-hmm. This is fascinating, and we'll be looking forward to that work as well. Thank you very much, Dr. Nair, for joining us and for your insights.
Thank you, Elise. This was an absolute pleasure.
Of course, the pleasure was all mine. Thank you for being with us. I'm your host, Elise Arıcan. This discussion of Set Adrift, Capitalist Transformations and Community Politics Along Mumbai's Shores, published by Oxford University Press in 2021, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.